And our final presenter this afternoon is Amy Casper. She is an EIS officer at the CDC National Center for Environmental Health.
Good afternoon, everyone. Today I'll present an introduction to disaster-related mortality surveillance and how we can use state-based electronic death registration systems to improve surveillance during disaster events. So, quick overview of my talk. First, we'll just introduce what a disaster is and why it's important to do mortality surveillance during and after disaster events. Talk a little bit about what electronic death registration systems are and how they can be used during disasters, and what progress we've that's been made towards using them for this. So, first, let's define disaster. It's a serious disruption of a functioning society causing widespread human, material, or environmental losses that exceeds the local capacity to respond and calls for external assistance. And there's three basic types of disasters: natural, human-induced, and complex emergencies. So natural disasters, for example, are things like tornadoes, hurricanes, flooding, landslides, and earthquakes. Human-induced disasters are things like industrial accidents, transportation accidents, and hazardous chemical exposures. Examples of man-made disasters are the Gulf Coast oil spill or the Boston Marathon bomb. Complex emergencies are disasters that can result from several different hazards, or more often, to a complex combination of both natural and man-made causes and different causes of vulnerability. So the earthquake in Haiti is a good example of a natural disaster that was exacerbated by underlying poverty and government instability. So why do we want to conduct disaster-related mortality surveillance? So first, we want to know how many people died during a disaster. And we'd like to be able to guide the public health response with some good rationale, evaluate the impact of any interventions that are done, enable officials to reply to media inquiries, inform public health policy and support, and then, of course, plan for future disasters. So to look at this another way, here's the disaster life cycle. So starting with response in the lower right-hand corner, mortality data provide situational awareness and guide emergency response efforts. These data can help target response and recovery efforts by identifying people at high risk of morbidity and mortality. In the mitigation phase and preparedness phases, these data can be used to improve strategies to prepare, respond, and recover from future disaster events. What sets apart disaster-related mortality surveillance from other types of mortality surveillance? So first of all, no two disasters are alike. They have variable impacts depending on the type and severity of the disaster, who and where it affects, and when it occurs. Next, it's not always clear if a disaster is a cause of a particular death. So underlying medical conditions, disruptions in services such as medicine and pharmacy, and transportation barriers can contribute to disaster-related mortality but are easily overlooked. And infrastructure disruption may also affect the ability to conduct surveillance activities. And besides the short-term impact, there are often long-term physical and mental health effects that can be difficult to measure, and there's no discrete end to a disaster's impact. So why aren't we doing this very well? This leads to the fact that there's a lot of room for improvement in disaster-related mortality surveillance. And first, there are many disparate sources of information, such as medical examiners and coroners, hospitals, the Red Cross, FEMA, and in the end, it's up to us, the public health officials, to reconcile all these lists to determine the number and the types of deaths. Disasters do not respect jurisdictional boundaries. Many death certifiers haven't received any training specifically on how to complete death certificates for disaster-related deaths. Also, disasters occur sporadically, meaning that few certifiers actually have a chance to practically gain experience in mass fatality management. And among death certifiers, there's actually no agreed-upon case definition of disaster-relatedness. But epidemiologists do have established disaster-related definitions. In 1999, CDC established definitions to classify mortality related to natural disasters. So a death is classified as being directly related to a disaster if it was caused by the environmental forces of the disaster or by the direct consequence of these forces. And an indirect related death is one that's caused by unsafe or unhealthy conditions or by the loss or disruption of usual services resulting from the disaster. So a real-life example to illustrate the challenges in conducting mortality surveillance during a disaster is the 2011 Southeast Tornado Cluster. For 3 days in April 2011, a major storm system spawned over 350 tornadoes. This storm system produced long-track tornadoes that crossed across state lines and through heavily populated areas. This disaster caused over 300 deaths, and there were a number of challenges in identifying these deaths. Patients who were sometimes transported across state lines for higher-level trauma care did not die in the same state where they lived. Disaster-relatedness was not consistently listed on death certificates, and some of the deaths did not occur for months after the event. Most of the deaths recorded were secondary to multi-trauma. However, 20 of these deaths were attributed to indirect effects of the storm, including one woman who fell down the stairs and sustained a traumatic brain injury while seeking shelter before the tornado even struck. So with this in mind, let's review the general death certification process for a paper-based system. This very simplified schematic shows the flow of information from a death to its registration with vital statistics. So a death certificate has two sections, one to be completed by the funeral director and another a medical certifier. Once the certificate is signed, the funeral director files it with the state or local health department, and the health department then registers the certificate and sends the date of death file to the state vital statistics office. And at the state vital statistics office, the record is reviewed again and indexed, processed, and stored for querying and analysis. And finally, the state then transmits death certificate records to the CDC's National Center for Health Statistics, where national statistics are produced. So say you want to use death certificates for disaster-related mortality surveillance. There are two types of limitations to consider. One are the general limitations of the death certification process, and two, the limitations specific to disaster-related mortality recognition and reporting. Regarding the death certification process in general, it relies on the input of different people, which often leads to delays before a death record is registered. Second, health departments are often unable to access data in the system until it's finalized, which limits its usefulness in tracking urgent threats to the public health. And finally, death certificates are prone to error and mistakes are common due to things like poor handwriting or poor copy quality. So additional challenges specifically for disaster-related mortality surveillance are that there are actually no clear case definitions or reporting guidelines. I do want to stress that determining disaster-related mortality is not a simple process, and research has found that disaster-relatedness is not being consistently recorded on death certificates, which leads to underreporting of disaster-related deaths. So as an example, here's a paper death certificate filed after the tornado cluster that I mentioned earlier. Death certificates are based on a 2003 standardized death certificate, but states can adapt the form. So to orient you to this particular form, part one is the chain of events that directly cause a death, and part two, this is kind of hard to see, lists other conditions that are indirectly contributing to the death. So the person in this example clearly died as a result of the tornado, sustaining multiple blunt force injuries. Note though, the word tornado is only listed in the text description on how the injury occurred. So you can see that this is free text, and without any guidance, the certifier could use terms that are not searchable in the end, meaning this. So how can we improve this process? One tool that's being implemented in vital records jurisdictions throughout the country is the establishment of electronic death registration systems, or EDRS. By digitizing this process, we're able to streamline death certification and registration. I'll go into a little more detail later in the presentation, but by switching to electronic death registration, the process, which previously took months to years to complete, is now taking just days. And the preliminary death record can be accessed, allowing the information to be used in emergency response or identifying emerging threats to health. EDRS has already demonstrated the ability to conduct near real-time surveillance, and one example of this is the NCHS National Vital Statistics System for Pneumonia and Influenza Mortality. This map shows the states or territories that have an EDR system up and running. As of March 2015, 45 out of 51, or 88%, of vital records jurisdictions have EDRS. So how can we use EDRS to improve disaster-related mortality surveillance? This slide is the same slide that I showed earlier, which is the schematic of a death registration system that this is electronic. After a death occurs, The certifying physician typically has 24 hours to certify a death record into EDRS. Edits can be made at any time, and preliminary data files can be accessed even before a death record is officially registered. The funeral director usually has 48 hours to complete a record, at which point the health department will register the record. For the majority of jurisdictions with a well-established EDRS, there are rules in place to get the data in quickly, and by 2016, CDC has set a target for death records to be registered to the state within 24 hours and transmitted within 10 days to NCHS. The improved timeliness is beneficial to families and also helps, if necessary, guide any public health response and allows access to information during a response. This information can also be compiled across jurisdictions. The move to electronic entry will improve data quality and thus the accuracy of our public health preparedness efforts and future research. Another important advantage is that EDRS records can be securely transmitted to other states, which allows for the prompt lockdown of a decedent's identity by linking the death and birth records. So there are other capabilities and options that EDRS offers. One potential option is to include some sort of prompt to flag or record disaster relatedness. This can be done by adding a disaster-related checkbox or perhaps a pop-up window reminding certifiers to explicitly state disaster relatedness in the cause of death field. Since the system is electronic, these checkboxes could be programmed to appear only during a disaster. During Hurricane Sandy, New York City used a pop-up window. Note this is not the actual pop-up window that they use. So it was used to remind certifiers to alert medical examiners and coroners to that they needed to record disaster relatedness to Hurricane Sandy. And medical examiners and coroners were given specific directions on how to do this on the death certificate so it was counted as a related death. Other EDRS features that are useful during emergency response are the ability to do keyword searches, access to the preliminary and final data in the established SQL Server format, and the ability to visualize and map the deaths. So what are the main advantages of using EDRS for disaster-related mortality surveillance? It's timely. It shortens the certification process to just days. Furthermore, preliminary data, as I mentioned before, can be accessed during the disaster and then shared promptly between states and federal agencies involved in response activities. It's useful knowing the numbers of deaths quickly helps appropriately target interventions and justify ongoing requests for resources. It's flexible. Errors can be corrected and the record can be updated in near real time as needed, and the system can be adapted during a disaster to adjust to evolving concerns. It improves data quality by reducing human error and enhancing security. Also, the rollout of this framework will be an opportunity to standardize recording of disaster relatedness and provide training to death certifiers. And finally, this is a system that is being adopted nationwide. All jurisdictions are currently moving from paper-based systems to EDRS. So there are some anticipated disadvantages to using the system. However, many of the downsides are inherent to the complexity in death certification in general and are not specific to EDRS. EDRS does not eliminate the potential for human error. Electronic or not, any surveillance system using death certificates relies upon certifiers to correctly identify and explicitly record the death was disaster-related. Changes to EDRS may be costly upfront, though costs should be minimal after the system is in place. That being said, it is important to keep in mind that changes could be cost prohibitive and time intensive for cash-strapped jurisdictions. It's also important to consider that during a disaster, certifiers may have competing priorities, such as patient care or performing autopsies, and may not want to use a system that they're not 100% familiar with. So it's important to train hospital staff and medical examiners and coroners of the usefulness of EDRS as an active surveillance tool. The system does rely on resources such as electricity, internet, and trained staff that may not be available during a disaster. Although in New York City during Hurricane Sandy, vital statistics staff were able to remotely access EDRS from an alternative site after the offices were flooded. And finally, applying EDRS to disaster mortality surveillance is a multidisciplinary effort which requires buy-in from multiple stakeholders. So where are we now? So first, we've identified the stakeholders, people engaged in death certificate reporting and recording, as well as the general public. There are many people involved in disasters and many people involved in death reporting, so this is a long list of different points of view to consider. We then established the Disaster-Related Mortality Surveillance Workgroup, or DRMS, from the Professional Associations of Medical Examiners and Coroners, Vital Statistics, and Public Health. This collaborative working group was formed to improve disaster-related mortality surveillance in the U.S., which includes leveraging EDRS. The professional associations or agencies in this collaboration are the National Center for Health Statistics, the National Center for Environmental Health, the National Association of Public Health Statistics and Information Systems, or NASIS, the Council of, CSTE, can say that, the National Association of Medical Examiners, or NAME, and the International Association of Coroners and Medical Examiners. So the objectives of this working group were to develop guidelines on registering and certifying disaster-related deaths, and to determine how best to prompt death certifiers and EDRS, such as the use of flags or pop-up windows. The work group participants were organized, and twice per month teleconferences were initiated in November of 2014. The collaboration culminated in a mortality summit that was held in April, which was attended by medical examiners, coroners, forensic pathologists, epidemiologists, administrative officials, and a meteorologist. The group developed resources for certifiers to improve disaster-related mortality surveillance, and we expect that these resources will be cleared and co-branded before the end of the year. The work group completed a draft of a reference guide with detailed instructions to certifiers on how disaster-related deaths should be certified. The reference guide includes one-page instruction sheet and an example scenario that can be used for certifiers to test their knowledge. Finally, the guide includes a flowchart that is meant to be displayed in a prominent spot for quick reference. So this is the draft quick reference guide that was developed by the work group, and we anticipate using this as a central part of training in the determination and recording of disaster-related deaths for death certifiers. So our next step is to continue the DRMS work group to engage stakeholders. We're going to finalize and disseminate the guide, encourage states to incorporate the guide into their disaster and mass fatality plans, and continue to collect states' use of these flags and alerts within EDRS for events, and develop a list of best practices. Some anticipated challenges are that there is actually no universal EDRS, and so up to now, each jurisdiction has been responsible for identifying their own vendor, and in some cases, actually developing their own system. Harmonizing the data that's collected from different systems may be a significant challenge. Next, the surveillance depends on the capacity and willingness of individual death certifiers to identify and report that a death is disaster-related. And then next, the states need to be on board as well, and strapped human and financial resources may prevent all states from engaging. However, this year, NCHS has secured significant funds to provide grants to up to 22 states to implement or improve their EDRS, but states must apply and demonstrate political will to advance their EDRS. So in conclusion, there's no national surveillance system for disaster-related deaths, but it may be eventually possible through EDRS. EDRS is making the death certification process more simple, timely, and accurate. And vital statistics, state epidemiologists, and preparedness directors need to be engaged for EDRS to be realized as a disaster surveillance system. And I'd like to give a quick plug for a roundtable discussion tomorrow morning at 7:30 in room Vegan F over at the Sheridan. And my group and Margie from NCHS will be discussing improving disaster-related death reporting on death certificates by enhancing interactions between epidemiologists, vital registrars, and medical examiners and coroners. And a lot of co-authors and people to thank. Thank you.
Just a quick question. I think all of this, and we can ask fatality planning at the state level and then also at the local level, but what struck my mind was the liability and the legal issues associated with tying a specific death at the time of death to a specific incident, especially if it's man-made. And the use of the death certificate with that notation on it for future lawsuits.
Yeah.
So did you go through a discussion on
this? So this has come up before, and this is still something that's being discussed. It's a very important consideration, though. It's something that people are concerned about, definitely.
How does getting ICD codes cause death stuff in might that be part of this process?
So right now, so the paper-based records, they go through the, they get coded with the ICD-9 code. That doesn't include things like the name of the disaster, or sometimes it doesn't, as if you don't write specifically that this was caused by Hurricane Sandy, that's not going to be translated into an ICD-9 code. And also the name of the disasters, and there's no ICD-9 code for that. So, I think that's a useful tool, but this has the potential to be more sensitive and pick up additional deaths we might not be able to pick up just through.
Would you mind going back and showing us the flowchart again, that one-page kind of decision-making process? Because I was specifically interested in thinking about extreme weather events, whether they're like an official declared disaster or not, this could be used for that. Is that correct? Like, I mean, if there was a heavy precipitation event that wasn't an officially declared disaster, this could still capture that potential. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And it would be up to the local jurisdiction to decide, okay, we're going to activate our disaster-related flags and EDRS. And that would be up to the jurisdiction to decide when to do that. That's a good question. I imagine it would be up to the individual jurisdiction to come up with their own. So we're going to have to come up with a protocol for that specifically. I imagine it's the local public health who would make that decision in collaboration with local vital statistics offices.
Thank you.